You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The secretive Carlyle Group is purported to be one of the largest private equity firms in the world, with over $15 billion in hundreds of defense, aerospace, and telecommunications companies in its portfolio. A partial list of its employees reads like a directory of who's who in American government. Award-winning journalist Dan Brody first broke the story of the Carlyle Group in an article in Red Herring magazine. For over a year and a half, he conducted interviews with present and former employees of the group, and what he discovered has been characterized by some as shocking. Typical of his findings is how former President George Bush has repeatedly advised his son on foreign policy decisions directly tied to Carlyle investments. Peace Watch spoke with Brody recently about his findings, the legality of the practices of the Carlyle Group, and the research that went into his book, The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group.
Using Steve Norris as a springboard, as the co-founder of the company, I was able to branch out and get a number of ex-employees, folks that had done business with the Carlyle Group. Most everybody wanted to be off the record for fear of any sort of retribution or tainting in their business career. So there were a lot of anonymous sources in there, but there are a lot of folks who spoke on the record as well, including Steve. And Steve was invaluable in terms of getting information from the first half of Carlyle's existence from about 1987 through 1995.
Mm-hmm. He also could be considered perhaps a little bitter, considering the circumstances under which he left. He was actually forced out of the Carlyle Group, according to your research.
That's right. And, you know, in cases like this, you know, the sort of bitter ex-employee is both an investigative journalist's best friend and worst enemy, because you have to balance what they have to say with a very large grain of salt. So you have to go to other sources to confirm and deny things that they tell you. But at the same time, I found Steve to be a very accurate source. I checked up on all the things he told me, and they all checked out, so it worked out for the best. I was able to, you know, rely on some of the good work of my fellow journalists to pull it all together.
Now, we've been hearing about the Carlyle Group for, I guess, a couple of years now, about its impact on domestic and foreign policy within the U.S. government, particularly under the Bush administration. But can you take us back to the basics, the who, the what, and the whys of the Carlyle Group?
Sure. The company is a private equity firm, which essentially means that they buy and sell private companies. And they do this much the way that a mutual fund would buy and sell stocks. They would solicit investments from very wealthy individuals, institutional investors, and then go out and target acquisitions, turn those acquisitions around and sell them for a profit, much like a stock holding would do. But the difference between most private equity firms and the Carlyle Group is that Carlyle operates inside the Beltway. In fact, they play in these very heavily government-regulated industries like defense, aerospace, healthcare, telecommunications, things that depend on policy and legislation that is made in and around Washington, D.C. So what they've done is hired a number of very influential and well-known ex-politicians like George Bush Sr., like James Baker III, like John Major, the former Prime Minister of the UK, and the list goes on and on. So with these guys on their staff, they're able to, first of all, predict and be very on top of trends that are happening in Washington, D.C. and in policymaking around the industries that they're invested in. But they're also able to reach in and, you know, talk to whoever they need to, especially in the current administration, which is a very Carlyle Group-friendly bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm. And so what's wrong with that? I mean, is the Carlyle Group crossing over some boundaries into conflicts of interest, misdealings and power plays, or are they perhaps just doing what big business does at that level?
Well, I do think that they are crossing some boundaries. I believe strongly that our ex-politicians should be allowed to matriculate back into the citizenry and be private citizens again. And as part of that, they should be able to hold down jobs and even capitalize on what they learned and what they did while they were in public office. But when you get into a situation where you see George Bush Sr. working on behalf of a company that's very heavily invested in defense while his son is waging war, that is, in my mind, an egregious conflict of interest and something that has to stop and should be more closely regulated.
Would you go so far as to say that the Carlyle Group is actually profiting from this war?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. They're definitely profiting from the war. I mean, their defense holdings, any defense contractor profits from war. That's just the nature of that business. And, you know, in watching the coverage of the Iraqi war, you saw a number of Carlisle products, the Bradley fighting vehicles, that's a United Defense product, the Paladin gun systems, you know, airplane parts, all kinds of things. So, and that's why I think that the conflict of interest between the president's father and the president is something that can't stand.
And so would you say that the Bush administration has fought to have this invasion or launch this invasion into Iraq simply as a profit-making venture?
I certainly hope that that's not the case. But the fact that the appearance is there is enough to warrant a closer investigation and some regulation of that. Now, I'm not accusing anyone of corruption, but I am certainly pointing out the fact that these conflicts of interest do exist and they should be closely scrutinized. And it's also not clear to me why a simple thing like George Bush Sr. resigning from a company like the Carlyle Group, why he doesn't simply resign, when I think that working for the company does tarnish his reputation, and I think it also undermines the credibility of his son in office.
And so September 11th was a significant date for the Carlyle Group. According to your research, Osama bin Laden's estranged half-brother, Shafiq bin Laden, represents the family's business in the Carlyle Group and was attending the annual Carlyle Investor Conference on that day, September 11th, in Washington. What, if any, connection is there between the Carlyle Group and the events that actually took place at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon?
Oh, well, the only connection between the two is the fact that the Carlyle Group has done business with the bin Laden family in the past. And the fact that the Carlyle Group was holding their annual investor conference on the morning of September 11th, and so you had all of these high-profile American politicians, in fact, international politicians, side by side with, you know, Shafiq bin Laden, who was there looking after the investments of the bin Laden family. That was just a tragic coincidence, really. And we should be careful not to go so far as to say that, you know, Carlyle Group and September 11th had anything to do with each other, other than the fact that the events of September 11th really shone the spotlight very brightly on the Carlyle Group, because it came out shortly afterwards that they were invested with the bin Laden family. So, and that shortly changed after September 11th.
Well, what do you mean? How so? How did it change?
The Carlyle Group ended their relationship with the bin Laden family and divested themselves from them because the publicity was just too bad for them to bear.
Mm-hmm. And what happened actually on that day? There are stories. Have you done any research around how the bin Laden family was allowed to leave Washington?
Yeah, I did some reporting on that. I didn't want to get too far into that because I don't think that that's where the story of the Carlyle Group is, where the heart of this story actually is. But I did do some research into that, and there were certainly reports that the bin Ladens, not just Shafiq bin Laden, but the other bin Ladens who were in the States at the time, were ushered out of the States for their own safety. What's more important about the Carlyle Group and what the morning of September 11th demonstrates is that you've got a very small number of people and a high concentration of wealth operating throughout the world internationally, and that's why you can have the confluence of people that we saw on September 11th at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C., at the Carlyle Investor Conference, and such an ironic and tragic confluence of people.
Mm. It is curious, however, and you can tell us, is it true, is it verified, that Secretary of War or Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld slashed spending for infrastructure at the Pentagon? And if so, when did he do it?
Oh, he did this a while ago, and there were a number of Washington think tanks that were calling for a cutting of the administrative costs throughout the Pentagon and a beefing up of some of the defense assets and some of the weapons procurement. And at that time, Frank Carlucci was an advocate of that move. The reason that I think that Frank Carlucci's involvement in that kind of thing, Frank Carlucci was former Secretary of Defense under Reagan. I think it's inappropriate, first of all, because him and Don Rumsfeld are very close friends. They attended Princeton University together. They were roommates at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And also because Frank Carlucci is no longer in government. He is a private citizen. He is a businessman. So it's not clear to me why he is advising our Secretary of Defense on procurement policy or spending policy at the Pentagon, particularly when his company stands to benefit from some of those changes.
And so what do you make of that?
Well, I look at it as the classic revolving door of Washington, D.C. These guys are never to be found too far away from the Beltway, and then they're able to bring their influence to bear on the folks who remain in office. And this is a very different kind of influence than lobbying or things that are more transparent. Obviously, lobbying is one of the more transparent forms of influence in Washington, D.C., but there is a much more opaque form of influence that takes place, and that's the kind of influence that Frank Carlucci would have on Donald Rumsfeld or George Bush Sr. would have on George W. Bush. These are things that are not measurable, and they're not provable either unless you're a fly on the wall during one of their conversations.
Mm. You write in your book that the White House is full of ex-Carlisle employees, friends, and business associates, and your materials also suggest that George W. owes his presidency to two Carlisle Group members, James Baker III and, of course, his father. How does Baker factor in?
George W. Bush owes his presidency to two men in particular. One is to his father, who lent him his legacy and his name, obviously, and two is James Baker III, who went down to Florida to fight the recount for George W. Bush and won that. If you've read anything about that recount, you know how critical James Baker III's role was in winning that recount.
What was he actually doing?
He was the head of operations. He was the chief of staff of the whole group of Republicans that were down in Florida, and he was directing everyone and directing strategy, legal strategy, and logistical strategy.
I would suppose that the legalities of what he was doing would then be called into question.
Oh no, I think James Baker III was operating well within the law. He was actually using the law to George W. Bush's advantage during that recount.
Now, President George W. Bush has connections to the Carlisle Group, as you stated, through his board connections with Cater Air.
Right.
Failed in-flight catering business. But the relationship is more extensive than that. Outline the past and present relationship President Bush has with this Carlisle Group.
Well, President Bush was appointed to the board of a Carlisle company in 1990, a company called Cater Air. This is an airline catering company that was one of Carlisle's actually least successful investments. He was on the board between 1990 and 94, and he ended up leaving just as the company was really heading towards bankruptcy very quickly. And in 1994, of course, he ran for governor of Texas. And then a few years after that, his father took over a position as a senior advisor to the Carlisle Group in 1998.
And so does he have current connections or present connections with the Carlisle Group?
Well, certainly between his father and between Frank Carlucci and James Baker III, all very close with the Bush family. David Rubenstein, the other co-founder of the company, along with Stephen Norris, is extremely close with the Bush family. You know, so there are very close ties between this company and the current administration.
So, and again, they're not doing anything illegal, but the question of conflict of interest.
That's right.
Or what about the matter of improprieties?
Right, and it's an important distinction to make, too, because I think that what I'm hoping will happen is that there will be more regulation and there will be eventually some legislation that regulates these activities, this revolving door in Washington, because I think that with the Carlisle Group, with some of the stuff that's going on with Halliburton right now, we've got a situation where we obviously have these politicians too closely tied to the business community. And when we're talking about spending taxpayers' money, there has to be more of a voice for the taxpayer in this process. And I'm hoping that some change will come out of this. So there are no laws that govern this sort of activity, and I think that that's what has to change.
Dan Briotti, award-winning journalist and author of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlisle Group. Shortly after the invasion of Iraq began, the U.S. military distributed decks of cards containing the faces of 52 of the most wanted senior members of the Iraqi leadership. Pictures of these decks appeared all over the media. They were a hot item for sale on eBay, and CNN even began showing pictures from the deck and referring to their suit and number whenever Iraqi officials were captured. But now, playing off the attention that deck received, the activist prankster group The Yes Men has created its own deck, not of the most wanted Iraqi officials, but of the most unwanted American officials. Peace Watch spoke recently with Andrew Bickelbaum, one of the creators of the deck.
Well, the Ace of Spades is Dick Cheney, and it goes through the other hawks like Wolfowitz and, of course, the Justice Department head, Ashcroft, and finally down to Bush at the Four of Clubs, all the people who in one way or another, including a lot of heads of corporations like Ford and ExxonMobil, who are intimately concerned with and, of course, in favor of the kind of war that was just led.
Mm-hmm. And Bush is only the Four of Clubs?
Yeah. Might have been a bit of an exaggeration, but we wanted to highlight the fact that there's this enormous power structure that goes hugely beyond any one man or even the administration, and that that's really to be considered the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Condoleezza Rice is the Ten of Clubs.
Yeah, she's on there. Anybody who's contributed to making the war possible, Henry Kissinger is on there as one of the main shapers of Iraq policy in the past, leading up to this.
Mm-hmm. Also, former President George Herbert Walker Bush is on these cards as the Four of Spades. How did you determine exactly who got which card?
Well, it wasn't completely scientific. We decided to put all the Bushes together the same way on the original cards. A lot of the Altakritis are together, Saddam Hussein's family. And in this case, it's a similar situation where you have a dynasty. Then as for the others, it was sort of a judgment call whether ExxonMobil was more important than Chevron, Texaco, or Ford more important than GM. It's a big complex of power that's led to the war, and we've tried to reflect that. Obviously, some of the media have a very big role in that. The Clear Channel sponsorship of a lot of pro-war rallies directly.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a memorandum that was reported in the Washington Post from the largest company that specializes in consulting to radio stations. And what this company advised was that radio stations not feature the protests too much because it just doesn't sell. It's just not good. It's in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You can read about it in the Washington Post. So obviously the media was extremely complicit.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of message are you really trying to convey by creating this deck? What are you hoping people will do with the deck?
Well, ideally we'd want to sow the idea of war crimes proceedings as being a reasonable thing to undertake in this case. And in fact, there are a lot of groups that are looking at doing just that, pursuing Bush as a war criminal. Of course, Kissinger is already being pursued for quite a while as a war criminal in certain countries, and people are looking at that with regard to Bush, and I think it's quite reasonable. This is the most illegal, most morally offensive war that I think the world has seen since World War II. It's certainly the first time that preemption has existed as a doctrine since Hitler used it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of commentary is on these cards?
So far, it's just a listing of the people's qualifications and positions and former positions. So for Cheney, for example, he's listed, of course, as the vice president and also the ex-CEO of Halliburton, which has gotten the main reconstruction contracts in Iraq, of course. Every one of them has their previous corporate affiliation listed, if any. For us, the main value of this is just as a kind of way of getting an idea across through the media. And it's kind of in general a way maybe for small groups of individuals to make an effect in the media, at least that's disproportionate to their numbers. So a little gimmick like this, however goofy, can actually sometimes go a long way, and it's fun to do besides.
Andrew Bickelbaum is a member of the activist prankster group, the Yes Men. His group created a card deck of the 55 most wanted American politicians and CEOs involved with the war on Iraq. It took just 3 weeks for the White House to declare military victory in Iraq, but many fear that reshaping that country into a democratic society may take years, inflicting an even greater humanitarian catastrophe on an already impoverished people, devastated by 12 years of economic sanctions. Speaking recently at Chapman College in California, journalist Alexander Coburn put the war and occupation of Iraq into an historical context, Coburn is co-author of the political satire magazine Counterpunch and the author of several books, including Al Gore, A User's Manual, and the best-selling novel Whiteout, The CIA, Drugs, and the Press.
The Iraq War is just a tiny chapter in a struggle where it shifts from location to location across the globe. But it's really always about the rich, the propertied, the affluent chunk of the world exercising continued domination over the poorer parts of the world who have made efforts to capture and retain their national resources. We need make no apologies for the regime of Saddam Hussein, but the nationalization of the Iraqi Petroleum Company did produce a measure of social wealth for more Iraqis than had ever happened before in their history. There was a time, 20, 30 years ago, when everybody in Iraq could enjoy access to free health care. Iraq was a vicious police dictatorship, but it also had a measure of a welfare state. What was the real consequence when America lured Saddam to the feeling that he could attack Kuwait with impunity in 1990? The sanctions were imposed, the bombs were dropped to destroy infrastructure, all of which are war crimes. They hanged a German general, Seyss Inquart, after World War II for breaching the Dutch dikes and causing widespread famine and harm. They hanged him. The Pentagon planned deliberately the onslaught on the water systems of Iraq and the power systems of Iraq to degrade the civilian population, and by the same standard, people from the Pentagon under which should have been in the dock for war crimes and strung up. So when you look at the larger picture, that is the real war. And it's a war that the press have paid almost no attention to, not on a year-by-year basis. We've seen now we have the troops in Baghdad. You'll probably have Iraqi opposition regrouping, fighting a guerrilla war. This could go on for year after year. What you undoubtedly will see, though, is the social situation for people in Iraq getting steadily worse. How many people now, how many stories do you now read about what Kosovo is like? There was no, by the way, UN approval for that. The UN wasn't even consulted. Decade after decade, when the UN hasn't clicked its heels, the US has said, we're going ahead anyway. It's quite right to protest, but we're reenacting a same old scene. That's the real war. And it began after the Second World War, when there were two paths. The two paths were, could the Third World develop in a way that allowed it to get a decent price for its raw commodities, have access to international capital, have the materials and the resources to carve its destiny? All across the Middle East, social reformers tried to inaugurate a new day. Iran, they tried to have land reform. What happened? The CIA assisted with a coup and installed the Shah. The Shah of Iran was finally overthrown, which produced the Ayatollah Khomeini. Iraq had a reform movement. What happened? The CIA helped Saddam Hussein to power, gave him the list, all the lists that had accumulated of progressive professionals across Iraq, and said, these are your enemies, and they were all exterminated. These are long, long wars. And what you have from the media is a flickering, brief, spasmodic interest, where everything is presented in caricature. What have we seen now? We've seen a kind of comic strip drama. First of all, you have Saddam Hussein, a brutal dictator. It's true. The worst dictator in the history of the world? No. An intolerable threat to the United States? Absolutely not. You have had the President of the United States claiming, despite all the findings of the UN teams, yes, there were weapons of mass destruction. Iraq had to disarm. Yes, Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were hand in glove. Yes, Iraq presented a real and present threat to the United States. Did these claims receive adequate scrutiny in the press? I don't think anyone who's watched the caricature unfold on these networks would have the remotest idea of what political reality is. What do 20 dead children who've been killed with a cluster bomb look like close up? Why was the United States obsessed with Saddam Hussein? A vastly impoverished country which had been driven relentlessly back into the bottom basement of the Third World, why was it being invented as a threat? What were the reasons? Was it about oil? Was it an effort hatched in collusion with Likud hawks in Israel to rearrange the chairs in the Middle East, finish off Iraq as a challenge to Israeli interests, change regimes in Syria, maybe attack Iran. You can read 100 different reasons. The answer, a mixture of all of them. There's no single strand you can say, this is it. But it is quite clear that an extreme faction in the making of U.S. policy, which has been present and maneuvering across the last 30, 40 years, has attained absolute dominance. We are at an extremely perilous moment. The world is an extremely fragile place. There have been some very mad and dangerous people on the levers of power for a very long time, but if you look across the Bush administration, you are looking at a collectivity of rashness and of fanaticism. Now, will they discover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If they possibly can, and if they can't, they'll probably make them. And after all, the U.S. has got plenty of weapons of mass destruction. Who wants to spare a few to put in some bunker that Saddam Hussein might have once inhabited? The efforts to justify after the event are great, but not that great. They'll say after a while, it wasn't really about weapons of mass destruction. They can make these reasons and throw them away in a day. Right after they had said Saddam Hussein might be in a bunker under a restaurant, they send in a plane, they kill 9 people with rockets who lived in houses next door, and then when people say, well, did you kill him? They say, well, we don't really care if we did or not. Osama bin Laden, who's he? He's not really the issue. There's something so contemptuous about the way they pick up a reason, hold it up to the people, say, look at this, look at this. This is why you should be frightened. And then when it's served a momentary purpose, toss it aside and bring up another one. And the thing to remember is not to forget these places as they go by. People should go back to Nicaragua and say, what is the mathematics of what happened since the full weight of the American empire descended on one small country? Yugoslavia is a wasteland. They said after the Soviet Union fell, the capitalist way would produce a prosperous and vibrant Russia. One can't just forget the world and accept the caricature. One has to try and always remind oneself and remind people of what the reality is. And to see what has dominated our consciousness for months now as the supreme fight against Saddam, see that in a historical context as an episode of a familiar story, a familiar tragedy, but one which will be with us always, but which we have to contest.
Journalist Alexander Coburn speaking at Chapman College. Special thanks to Dave Adelson and Mule Man for production assistance with that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.